Hello, and welcome to Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Sam, and we're going to be discussing the new Teen Titans. We're going to be doing the first half of the first volume of the trade paperback that covers DC Comics Presents number 26 that had a 14-page preview of the new Teen Titans series, and then we're going to cover the first four issues. How you doing tonight, Sam?
I am doing well!
Now, this is one of my favorite series in comics. It was something I got into pretty early on. I think I discovered it around the fourth issue, and I don't remember how much longer it took me before I was getting it, you know, on a regular basis, because I was hitting the spinner rack at that point. And I think once I found the comic shop, that helped a lot. But I love this series, I love these characters, and I really think Marv Wolfman and George Perez were like the creative team to beat in the early 80s, and particularly on this title.
Yeah, I am a little bit later to this particular title. I hopped in somewhere probably in the mid-90s. It was my first Titans book. Well, when Donna Troy was a Dark Star, if that gives you an idea of the era.
Oh, wow. That's much later.
Much later. And I stuck with it pretty much all the way through until about the end of the New 52, and then have gone back all the way to the beginning and kind of caught up since then.
At some point, and it must have been, I think, like in the 90s or something, I actually went back through and reread the series from the beginning to wherever it was at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this is just some great stuff. Now, this started with a 14-page story that was a bonus feature in DC Comics Presents, issue number 26. Now, just to set the scene for the value proposition of the time, that comic, DC Comics Presents number 26, had a lead feature of Superman, Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, because he was the Green Lantern of the time. There weren't all these others. That lead story was 17 pages. It had a backup feature of Whatever Happened to Sargon the Sorcerer, which was an 8-page backup. It had this, which was another 14 pages for the New Teen Titans preview. So you got 39 story pages for a whopping 50 cents cover price. Hard to go wrong with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you get basically a 14-page, you know, preview of something and the lead story is 17 pages, I mean, you feel like you pretty good get a pretty good-sized story there.
Oh, yeah. No, and this story, as much, you know, happens or not happens, depending on what actually happened here, as would happen in at least a full issue, if not several issues these days.
Yeah, I do think that's going to be one of the recurring refrains in this discussion, is just how much is happening here. Because when I was going through and kind of putting together my notes as I read the first four issues, I was able to give, you know, pretty much a bullet point, here's what happened in the issue for each of the four real issues, and it was a different thing per. Whereas in today's day and age, you would get a six-issue opening arc for a new title.
Well, and to be fair, there is an overarching story here that where does it finally kind of, is it all the way in eight or?
It's like six or somewhere eight, somewhere in there, where they yeah, start to really ramp up the whole Trigon stuff and
exactly,
get through the, well, gathering the band, I guess would be the way to put it.
Oh, yeah. But like I said, and that is a story that's introduced here in this preview.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in some ways.
The preview I thought was kind of interesting because at this point, the Titans haven't been active for some time, and we've got a, I'm going to call it a framing sequence, but really they intercut between this and the other thing, with Robin dealing with a situation at a local Star Labs, I'm not even sure what city he's in, presumably Gotham, and he kind of blacks out and almost like jumps forward in time to where he's with the Titans and they're in the tower, and of course, you know, that page of the preview is like the first time we're seeing some of these characters.
I think all these, well, okay, yes, there's a couple of characters that don't exist yet.
They cheat a little because the first two Titans he encounters is Wonder Girl, whom he knew from the previous run of Teen Titans that had ended a few years earlier. Beast Boy, now going by Changeling. But then we get introduced to Cyborg and Starfire. And it's not until I think that, I guess early on in this, we even get Raven in here.
Yeah, well, yeah, we get Cyborg and Starfire. And then Kid Flash, of course, shows up on that same page.
Yeah, yeah. So
and then Raven on the next.
The team is kind of split evenly down the middle, which is interesting for a 7-person team of half old, half new. And I'm counting Gar Changeling as kind of that half and half, because he was an established character and he'd been a member of, I think it was the Titans West group, but not the Teen Titans proper.
And didn't he start out as, what, Doom Patrol?
Yeah, he was mainly a Doom Patrol character.
Yeah.
Because he was the adopted son of Mento and Elastigirl.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what within a year or so, grandfathers the Doom Patrol kind of into the Titans franchise when, I think it's around issue, 13 or something, some of these characters are looking of, well, whatever happened to the Doom Patrol?
Now, have you ever gone back and read the Titans before this?
You mean the original run of the Titans?
The original run of the Titans.
Yes. Not all of it, but a lot of it. A lot of the later stuff.
Because I gotta say this, I do have that Bronze Age omnibus, and I love this series, and as I said, I went all the way back to the beginning and have read it all and love it, and I stuck through some pretty, what many people would argue were lean years through the 90s and, mm-hmm. you know, all the way to the New 52, and I enjoyed most of those. Those Bronze, and I'm a Bronze Age guy, I like a lot of that stuff. But man, a lot of that Silver and Bronze Age Titans is just a slog. Not for me. If you love it, great, but man, that it is very, very different.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think there's a fundamental difference between the new Teen Titans we're getting here and the Teen Titans we'd gotten just a couple of years earlier. Because I think that series ended in 76 or 77, I forget when. And even that, the last, 9 issues, was like a revival when it had gone away for a little while. But that earlier Titans series, particularly early on, that was when you had adults trying to ape the lingo of the teens, and it was kind of a swing and a miss. It's like they got the words, but it just didn't feel quite right. You know, everything was hip daddy-o, you know, and part of it was some of this was, you know, late 60s, early 70s, so, you know, it was a little more timely then than it is now. But they were so focused on trying to portray these as cool kids versus just legitimate characters and people.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, maybe I should start halfway through that book and try again, because starting at the beginning, I have not been able to get more than 3 or 5 issues into it.
That would be one that would be fun to do as a back issue spotlight at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. It would give me an excuse to finish it.
Yeah, and it'd give me an excuse to go back and reread some of those, because like I said, I've read a number of them, because some of those were what was reprinted in the DC Digests that they did in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So I've read some of the earlier Titans stuff. I've got, I'm pretty sure, those Bronze Age collections sitting over here on my bookcase, but I haven't, you know, cracked them open and gone through them. But the difference here is Marv Wolfman was treating them just as younger heroes, not trying to, ooh, they've got to sound like hip kids.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are really young adults in the way they act, in the way they go about things, and the way they interact, particularly with the Justice League. So I think that going for a more grounded, kind of realistic approach versus, you know, these are the kids' sidekicks and whatnot, it may not seem like that big of a difference, but it really colors, I think, the entire take that Wolfman and Perez had on this group, and part of why it became basically the premier super team of the 80s. You know, at one point, this was, you know, if you were living in the DC universe at the time and you needed heroes to really get you out of a jam, you were actually better off with the new Teen Titans than the Justice League sometimes.
Yeah, those are interesting years for the Justice League. I know some people love them. Parts of them I've read, I really enjoy. A lot of it I haven't read, but it is a unique Justice League at that time, and it keeps getting more and more interesting.
Well, and right now we're talking early 80s is kind of the late satellite era.
Yeah, so you're talking like Firestorm and that group.
Firestorm, Elongated Aquaman. Man, Black Canary, Green Arrow, Red Tornado.
Yep.
Atom, Zatanna. I mean, you had Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman still members of the team, and they'd show up, but they were not like the mainstays.
Yeah.
Now, you go a few more years later when the Titans is still running, and you wind up with kind of the Bwahaha era of the Justice League, and it was more of a comedy book than a straight-up superhero book, at which point you were definitely better off with the Titans. But when I was going through rereading the preview, which I really haven't read in a few decades since... I'm trying to remember if I started with that when I went back through the entire run of the Titans when I reread it in the 90s or not, and I don't remember. It's been so long.
Well, in those days, you would have had to have remembered where it was and found the issue and...
Yeah, yeah. And that was actually probably one of the more expensive issues I got, because at that point, I wasn't get... I finally, you know, afterwards, or this may have been one of the last ones, built up a complete run of DC Comics Presents, which is a recommended series just as a sampler for the DC universe of the time. But this was one, number 26, that I got at back issue prices, and probably paid, I don't know, $10 for it or something, which I found just outrageous. But, you know, it had the Titans, so, you know, I kind of had to.
Yep.
One of the few kind of expensive, and I use that term in relative perspective, one of the more expensive back issues I'd picked up. So, what I can't really place yet, and maybe when we finish the later half of this trade or get into the next one, I can't place when the Teen Titans part of this preview story takes place. It's clearly after Titans Tower is built and in use, but where would this story, you know, of them dealing with the protoplasmic cell or whatever, where would it happen in the timeline if it indeed does happen? And I'm not 100% certain of that, but the way Raven is talking about how this was a sign of things to come or a vision of the future or something like that, it was hard to tell if she was referring to the people are real and they're in your future or the events are real and in the future.
Yeah, it's not really clear if this happens or, you know, could they just be displaced out, or some of them, well... really, two of them be displaced out of time and kind of on a time travel adventure.
Well, the one who was time traveling, if anyone, was Robin.
Well, and there's things about how you get about Cyborg in mixed into this story, too, that it's hard to tell how long he'd been Cyborg at this point.
It was unclear how long he'd been Cyborg, how long they'd had the tower, although it kind of felt sort of new.
Yeah.
So... It seems like it would be within the first year or so of the title. And maybe it'll become clear later on, maybe not. Now, I've got to say that the Titans Tower is one of my favorite locales of this era of the DC Universe. And don't get me wrong, I love the Justice League satellite, too. But if you look at that first page when we're seeing the inside of the tower and really the exterior of it, we've got the meeting room, the iconic T-shaped table and such, with the little logos on the tops of the seat backs for whose chair is whose. But the part that really stands out to me, and this is going to sound kind of ludicrous, but bear with me here, is there's the circular staircase in the back corner of the room.
Yep.
That's the exact staircase we see, I forget if it was Nightwing or Jericho or both kind of coming down about 4 years from now when this story is happening, and those characters get introduced. But the part I'm trying to call out here is one of the things I love about George Perez as the artist is he knows how this tower is structured. That staircase is always in that corner of this room, and if you read enough of the stories, you can kind of piece together the geometry and the layout of this building.
Yeah.
you know, a lot of artists just kind of wing it, and it's, oh, well, they go into the next room, and this week it's the kitchen, next week it's the meeting room, or, you know, the pool, or something like that, you know?
Yeah, and it takes a different level of commitment. You know, it's interesting, in comics especially, you know, artists are given style guides for characters all the time, but, yeah, you know, places like buildings and things, I'm not as convinced they have such things. As where this one, it's clear that Mr. Perez at least had one for himself.
And whether he was building it as he went and just stuck with it, or, you know, the order of events, I don't know and kind of don't care. But once he established something, it stayed established.
Yeah.
And this is part of why I'm a big fan of things like Who's Who and the Marvel Handbook, is because that's one of the places where they actually try to document, you know, what did, you know, the Avenger Mansion look like at a given point in time, or Titan's Tower or whatnot. And in the DC Heroes game, which is a role-playing game of the era, I forget which book it was in, if it was part of the main box set or one of the Titan supplements, they actually had a good couple of pages where it was a floor-by-floor layout of Titan's Tower.
Yeah, well, and that's one of those things. Well, clearly, like you said, within the role-playing, often got added as pin-ups or, you know, in other kinds of books or things like that as well. And those were always fun whenever they show up kind of in any book.
I'm trying to think if somewhere in the first couple of years of this series that they did kind of one of those pin-up pages of, you know, kind of a cutaway of what's on what floor of the tower and such.
Yeah.
Whereas in the role-playing game, it was actually kind of a floor plan-looking thing. But either way, in 14 pages, they kind of tell two mini-adventures, one of Robin solo in the present day, another with the Titans in the near future, and set up the, he's going to be meeting them really soon.
Yep.
So I thought it was fairly effective and fairly accessible.
Absolutely. And you also get a little, this is, I believe, where Raven's introduced, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you also get Raven introduced and a little bit about her powers and history, as well as you get a little bit about, you know, the Stone family and how they relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a lot in those 14 pages.
So I thought it was a good preview. It's nice that they were doing those things at the time, kind of, you know, free of charge, because the DC Comics Presents was normally 50 cents at the time, so they didn't charge extra for it.
That being said, the choice of the starred border drives me nuts, and it just feels like they're shrinking the artwork.
The reason they did that, though, this took place in the middle of the book. So you read 8 or 9 pages or whatever of that Green Lantern, Superman Green Lantern story. Then they had this special bonus preview, and then you continued the Superman Green Lantern story.
So in theory, you could undo the staples, take this out, restaple the two books, and have two separate comics.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure that's the way it was designed, at least in theory.
Yeah, that was the basic mindset, that this was just an insert that they could plug in.
Yep, that's kind of cool.
So we jump over to the first issue, and this is the, what I'm going to say the basic plot of this issue is, and granted, to your point, there is this overarching plot going through a number of issues. But here, they're basically, not that they know it at the beginning, but they're rescuing Starfire.
Yeah, exactly. This gives you the history of Starfire in many ways, and it gives you a little, quite a bit, actually, on Cyborg and Wonder Girl as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also sets up one of the main antagonists for the Teen Titans series. Because we get Grant, winds up being Grant Wilson, who next issue is going to become Ravager, and he's the son of Deathstroke, brother of Jericho, and the whole Wilson family is a huge part of the Titans' legacy, you know, over the next decade or two, or really, you know, 3 or 4, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't remember if Deathstroke himself was in this issue or not. But boy, he's front and center on the cover of 2, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, they cover so much ground here. Everything from a quick, you know, hey, Dick Grayson is living at the Wayne Foundation along with Bruce Wayne, because that's kind of the main Batman headquarters of the era. We get a recap of Wonder Girl's origin. We set up the question of who were her parents. You know, we get some of the spacefaring background of Starfire. We get Grant set up and his girlfriend Carol. She doesn't like the friends he's hanging with, all this kind of stuff. And there's just so much that's happening here. We get the implication Raven needs Robin to form the new Teen Titans, but
yep,
we're not quite sure why and if she's on the up and up or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, she's a member of the team, so hopefully she is kind of the presumption.
Well, yeah.
The other thing I kind of like about this series is Robin has been in, you know, a zillion comics, but I can't think of any other artist or series where we get kind of the casual look, if you will, for him, where you've got the tunic, but it's not kind of buttoned up and stuff. The cape is clearly a separate piece, you know, and things like that. And we get a couple of places in this series where you got, frankly, a more relaxed, laid-back Robin.
Yeah, that's definitely true, particularly at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and of course, after this, by the time this ends, you've got Nightwing, which is kind of his own character and his own right by that point, or distinctly different from being a Robin at that point.
Yeah, but there's aspects where we've got kind of the open-collar tunic in this series that makes me wonder if one of the main reasons for the change in the costume was to change the neckline of it, if you will.
Yeah.
But they just, so much is happening on these pages, and they feel wordy by today's standards, but they don't feel slow and dense.
No, not at all.
It's a long read, but it's also a 25-page story.
Yep.
So I enjoyed it quite a bit. You know, everything from the setup of Cyborg, you know, those couple of pages really properly introducing him, even though we'd gotten him in the preview. They didn't assume everybody had read the preview.
No, not at all. No, you can absolutely start here and get a pretty good idea who everybody is. Well, except Raven, but even they keep teasing, you know, she needs to get this team for, you know, it's what's needed for something that's months to come.
Yeah, even by the time we're done with issue 4, there's still some pretty open questions about Raven.
Yes.
I think they deal with that starting in issue 5 and whatnot, but even, you know, when they do the next New Teen Titans series, which was about 3.5-4 years later, and ran concurrently with this title, which was going by Tales of the New Teen Titans at that point, they ran concurrently for a year. Even in that other series, the opening story there is around Raven and Trigon again.
Yeah.
So there's a ton of story and stuff to deal with these characters.
Yeah. And then, like you said, you get set up at the end with, I guess, Deathstroke off-panel. Telling Grant, you know, hey, you want them destroyed, very well. The Hive shall see that it becomes true.
I don't think that was Deathstroke. I think that was his Hive contact.
You think so? Okay.
Basically closing the deal.
Fair enough.
Now, doing that, it seems like feet away from this team of superheroes seems a little gutsy to me. But, you know, hey, that's what they're going to do. It's the opening of the next issue, issue 2, where we get Deathstroke the Terminator.
Yes.
And he, of course, is a longtime antagonist and, at times, ally of the Titans. So, great character and stuff. We also get Hive. They'd been teased in the previous issue, but we start to actually see them. I believe that stands for Hierarchy of International Vengeance and Eliminations. I'm not going to say that's the catchiest of you know, names for a villainous organization, but at least it's straightforward and to the point.
Did either the Hive or Deathstroke exist before this, or do you know?
Deathstroke did not.
Okay.
Hive, I'm not so sure. I'm thinking they did not, but I don't know that for certain. If they did, I want to say they showed up in the Superman title.
Okay.
But that's where I'd have to go do some research.
Fair enough.
In this, we start to learn a little bit more about some of the characters, particularly one of the lesser-used powers of Starfire. In addition to flight, strength, and energy bolts, she has the ability to learn languages via physical contact. Her method of choice this issue is a long kiss with Robin. That, of course, is one of the long-term kind of romances of the series, which eventually leads to... Pretty sure they get married down the line. I know she gets married to somebody else at one point, but I think they get Trying to remember, actually. It's been long enough since I've read it, I've forgotten some of these things. Anyways, they were mainly on again, but occasionally off again here and there, because they're very different characters.
Well, yes.
He is so, I don't say rigid and whatnot, but stoic, and she's so emotional.
Well, and I don't remember who it was. I was listening to someone's podcast, and I apologize to whoever it was. And they were talking about Dick Grayson, and they were talking about that, and you know how Corey and Barbara are kind of like Betty and Veronica, and you know he needs to make a choice, and it would be interesting if he followed either of those, but you can't do the back and forth thing.
There have been times he's followed each of those.
Yes, absolutely, there have.
Yeah,
but depending on which kind of book or which side of books you're coming from, you know. You can read the Bat Family books and Corey almost doesn't exist. Same thing with Barbara almost non-existing in the Titans books.
Well, I think part of the problem with that, and certainly when Denny O'Neil was in charge of the Batman office, he didn't really feel aliens were right to put into the Batman corner of the universe.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, Superman's going to show up once in a while, but, you know, having Nightwing dating an alien really goes against kind of the street-level stories that they were trying to tell.
It makes sense as well.
The missed opportunity there is there was a period where Devin Grayson was doing a couple of one-shots and one-off stories here and there where she would pair up kind of some unusual pairings like Batman and Arsenal. And what you got in that story, in addition to a decent adventure with those two, was how different the relationship between Batman and Robin or Nightwing was from Green Arrow and Speedy or Arsenal by taking essentially the other guy's sidekick and pairing him with him.
Yeah.
The missed opportunity was to do a story with the Barbara Gordon Batgirl and Starfire.
I'm not sure they ever met until potentially almost recently.
I am sure they have met and been in the same crowd scenes. I would be hard-pressed to name any story that focused on the two of them.
Focused, yes, but where they were both clearly there and involved. I mean, you might have to go all the way into Scott Snyder's New 52 Batman with Death of the Family.
I'm sure I could find, like in Crisis on Infinite Earths or some other thing of that sort, a crowd scene or some major event that they were in proximity of each other.
Because Corey, at that point's in that team with Red Hood, who's clearly in that story, as is Nightwing.
I was thinking even earlier, like with the original Crisis and such.
Yeah, obviously. But like I said, the first story I can think of where they really are both clearly interacting kind of together and with each other is that one.
Yeah.
And again, there could be one before that, but
I don't think so. I mean, again, they may have shown up in the same sort of stories, but it was never about, they never had the moment where they would actually like talk to each other much.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm sure there had to be some in the 90s or the aughts or something like that, but if so, I'm blanking on it.
Yeah.
So really, the plot of this second issue is fighting Ravager and Deathstroke getting kind of sucked into that with Hive basically having given his son powers so they could pay him with the powers and get Deathstroke's, you know, services for free.
Yeah. Well, and then you get a couple of other interesting pages in here. You kind of get the page where Raven, you know, looks to communicate back to Trigon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the more kind of character moment where they're all just kind of hanging out at Gar's place.
Yeah, and that has one of the funner kind of panel sequences where Gar, in the shape of a dolphin, is diving into the pool as Kid Flash is kind of coming into the scene, changing into his swimsuit, diving into the pool. You know, we've got four panels there, and you could just see everybody kind of frozen in time as Wally's just speeding through the thing.
Yes. Well, and the three that are not diving in, you know, Wonder Girl, Corey, and Dick are all kind of off balance slash, what was that, as Wally flashes by them.
Mm-hmm. It's some great stuff.
Yeah.
And at this point, we know some of what's going on with Raven. We don't really know about Trigon. We get a little bit more with Vic and his father.
Yeah, that's true, too.
And I'm unclear how Ravager knew where to find Cyborg, but, you know, Hive presumably has its resources. And we get some fun fight scenes and stuff like this, and it's one of those things that what seems like just a, here's the villain of the week or whatever, again, the ramifications of this issue play out for decades to come, both in terms of, you know, what happens with Deathstroke and the Titans over the years, leading, you know, kind of the closest to this point in time with the Judas contract storyline, but then also later where we get the other Ravager, you know, and like I said, all the different members of the Slade-Wilson family having an impact on this group for just years and years and years to come.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of, not only Slade, but like you said, a lot of this sets up a lot of that character for, you know, stuff that still holds today.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some of this is stuff that has been pulled into various TV shows. A lot of it in Arrow, where we get Slade and Wintergreen and stuff in that show. So it's amazing how much use that DC, Warner, whatever, has gotten out of these characters in these storylines. You know, because again, there's also the Titans show on DC Universe and stuff like that. So, and Deathstroke wound up getting his own title a few times, at least one of them when I think like 50 issues or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this also establishes that Deathstroke has quick enough reflexes that he can actually deal with Kid Flash. I kind of question that.
I don't know about deal with, well, yeah, maybe deal with is the right. He clearly can't, he's not going to beat him in a race or anything, but he can not just be blown away by the Flash's speed.
Yeah. He has a fighting chance.
Yes.
We also get in this issue Kid Flash wondering if Raven's manipulated him into joining the Titans. That's building up the whole mystery of, is she good, is she not? And then we also get the hint that Cyborg's father is dying.
Yes.
So there's quite a few subplots getting kind of tossed in here that some play out quicker than others, but that's in addition to, you know, fighting Ravager, setting up Deathstroke, and just all the stuff that's happening. And again, 25 pages.
Yeah.
Now that's, you know, 25% more pages than most comics get today. But, and it's funny because we've talked about a number of other titles from the early 80s and how they've got a lot more going on and stuff like that. But this is the first ongoing series we've really discussed.
Well, and this one is different. Those were clearly, we've got this story and we've got to get closer to the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were miniseries. This, somehow they managed to do all of those things and still have the 6 to 8 pages for the, you know, you get the pool party, you get Vic and his father, you get Raven and Trent. They still build both the world and these characters in the extra pages, if such a thing could exist.
The funny thing is, I'm pretty sure that Wolfman, Perez, and pretty much everybody else involved with this title at the time didn't think it would last long enough to have filled out this trade paperback. They figured, oh, it'll go 6-7 issues, that'll probably be it.
Yeah.
Because that's about how long the previous Titans series had lasted. They went into this thinking, okay, we'll give it a try, there's nothing to lose.
Yeah.
And it became the breakout hit for DC in the 80s. You know, it's really what put them back on the map. I will have to go look up if Hive had shown up before this and how much Hive has gotten used kind of outside of this series afterwards. It's one of those, you know, kind of evil organizations that fall in and out of favor with writers over time.
Yep. And, you know, speaking of evil organizations that fall in and out of favor, moving on to the next issue, we get another group that, I'll be honest, there's only one of these characters I kind of know apart from this.
Which one is that?
Light.
Yeah, I kind of figured it was Dr. Light. So the plot of this issue is basically fighting the Fearsome Five.
Yep.
Mammoth, Shimmer, Dr. Light, Simon, and Gizmo. The only one that predates this issue is Dr. Light.
Okay, that makes sense.
And he was a loser around this point in time.
To be fair, depending on, and I know people have very strong feelings, both pro and con, wasn't until they made him central to Identity Crisis, Wasn't he always kind of a loser until that point?
I think this series did more to rehabilitate him as a viable villain.
Okay.
Because otherwise, he was always going solo up against the Justice League.
Yeah.
And let's just do the numbers game there. One villain, half a dozen heroes, half a dozen Justice Leaguers. You don't even need to know who the Justice Leaguers are. You can do the math. He's not going to win.
Yeah. Well, like I said, until Brad Meltzer decided to, in some ways, have him defeat, you know, 25 Justice Leaguers.
And even that was a serious retcon to make up for what a loser he was.
Yes.
Whereas here, instead of doing that kind of thing, it's basically, you know, Wolfman's approach was, okay, he's going to build up a team. He's going to even the playing field in terms of the numbers, get some help, and he'll actually do well.
Yes. Well, and he's Simon quickly kind of takes over this team, though.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But that's, you know, mentalist du jour or whatever of, yes. You know, he can read minds. He's, I think, got telekinesis and whatnot. Of course he's going to take over the damn team. What do you expect?
Yes.
The other characters, Mammoth is basically a big hulking tank kind of a type, not too smart. His sister Shimmer does matter transmutation, so she's a pretty serious threat. And then Gizmo, we were talking a couple of weeks back, Squadron Supreme.
Exactly this, what I was thinking.
This is the character I think that Tom Thun was kind of modeled after.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, we spent all that time going, oh, is he this or, you know, the Atom or... And then reading this right after that going, oh my God, this is really the model for that character.
I mean, I think what they did over there was, you know, we've got the Atom. He's a small, smart guy. But they didn't want to go the obvious route of, oh, he shrinks down or something.
Yep.
Which is funny because they could have done him as a riff on Henry Pym of the Avengers.
Of course.
But again, the parallels to Gizmo here, who's essentially a dwarf MacGyver.
Yep.
I mean, at one point, it's like, yeah, he has to catch up with the rest of the team, and it took him a minute because he had to basically turn a couple of fire extinguishers into a jetpack. So it's a cool character. The whole team is kind of fun. They show up periodically, and this is one of the main villain teams of this era of the Titans.
Yeah.
Now, in kind of the quote-unquote quiet pages of this issue, if you will, we get some of the backstory of Starfire.
Yep.
We get what is today a dated reference, but I thought it was kind of funny when Changeling's kind of, you know, joking about why Cyborg's not there. He referenced he was trying to rent himself out for Star Wars 3 to play C-3PO's brother, because this was before the third Star Wars movie, if you can remember such a time.
Oh, yes.
But they get just a lot done cutting between what's going on with the Titans, what's going on with the Fearsome Five. We get a real setup for Trigon here.
Yep.
Still not quite sure what his deal is at this point, but again, it's planting the seeds for the big payoff.
Yep.
And we get the introduction of the Tower.
Yeah, and you get another page or two with the Stone family.
Yeah, Vic and his dad.
Yeah.
At this point, have they clarified his accident and where what happened to his mom? I don't think so.
I think that's coming up.
Yeah, I think that comes later. But the introduction of the Titans Tower, you know, again, kind of cool. And just some of the backstory that we get from Raven. And what's interesting is she mentions some stuff with the Justice League, and there's clearly some backstory that we find out later of her having talked to the Justice League, but that never happened anywhere other than in these flashbacks.
Really?
I am positive she never showed up in the Justice League series solo prior to this.
And the Justice League never went to this world or anything?
Don't think so, but I'd have to... Because I think part of what she's saying here is what is going to happen that she's trying to prevent.
Oh, okay.
But then when they encounter the Justice League... Next issue, I think we get some comments where the Justice Leaguers recognize Raven and had talked to her before or something.
Got it.
The part I had forgotten was that Simon's origin was having gotten his powers from Trigon.
Yep.
Because I don't think we see that sort of a thing much later in terms of Trigon having empowered others. There was a Sons of Trigon story decades later. but that was a more literal than metaphorical sort of a thing. So again, a lot of this issue is just around the Titans encountering the newly formed Fearsome Five and whatnot. And I thought what happened, you know, after that battle and the clear defeat and stuff really set up some stuff for the next issue pretty well.
Oh yeah, of course.
So again, another 25-page issue, tons going on.
And moving on to the fourth issue, again, such a great cover and in many ways something you wouldn't see probably today. And the fact that it's a pinup style, absolutely. But the fact that the team that the book is based on kind of all has its back, you're looking over their shoulders,
mm-hmm.
and the main image is the Justice League.
Well, it's a couple of things, because you've got the Justice League facing us in the center, in the prime position on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
And the Justice League of America versus is above the New Teen Titans.
Yep.
Whereas I think the typical approach would have been to have had the New Teen Titans versus the Justice League, and then, like you said, flip the position of the teams.
Yeah.
But this is just a fun issue. The plot here is, well, it's the Titans versus the Justice League. And in this case, the Justice League is Batman, Green Lantern, Zatanna, Hawkman, Adam, and Wonder Woman. So a decent lineup for the Justice League.
Absolutely. And if I lost my mind, or just haven't read enough of that era of the Justice League, I do not remember Zatanna with the red unicorn stripe in the middle of her hair.
Oh, she absolutely had that.
Fair enough.
This is after, I'm going to say it's around issue, the late 180s or early 190s of the series.
Okay.
She went from having the ponytail look to this costume, which I'm pretty sure was designed by George Perez, who was the artist on Justice League at the time.
Got it.
Matter of fact, I think he might have even been like doing both books for a little bit before he had to choose and stuck with Titans. But he didn't want to give up Justice League because he wasn't sure Titans was going to go for any length of time. But yeah, that hairpiece she had, definitely an iconic part of her look at the time.
Fair enough.
What got me was when, again, they see Raven, they've clearly had discussions with her in the past of kind of, how many times do we have to tell you, kind of a go away, you bother us kid sort of approach. So again, there was nothing in the Justice League book to have set any of that up, but there didn't need to be because we were getting it here.
Yeah, and while they clearly, you know, it's interesting, because at the very beginning you get the, clearly Zatanna has linked in and understands the threat, you know, Trigon is.
She's aware of, but I would argue she does not understand.
Fair enough. But she's aware there's a threat there.
She's aware Raven claims there's a threat there, but because she sensed evil in Raven, she just kind of discarded it.
Okay.
At least that's how I took it.
Even if we delay even a moment more, I frankly fear for the fate of our world, though. Sounds like she's convinced something's going on. It's a threat.
Well, she's aware that there's something going on with these sorcerers or whatnot.
Yep.
But everything that Raven had been telling her, because apparently Raven had gone to the Justice League thinking, well, they'll help. They didn't, which is why she basically prompted Robin to reform the Titans.
The Titans, yeah.
You know, this is where we really start to get some good backstory on Trigon, and we get some clarity that, you know, after having been defeated by the Fearsome Five last issue, the Titans kind of got, you know, both their memory wiped a little bit and kind of manipulated a little to be a little bit more aggressive against the Justice League.
Yeah.
So some of this was some fun stuff. And this is also where Simon makes it very clear that he is in charge of the Fearsome Five, always has been, always will be.
Yep.
Which does not please Dr. Light, of course, but, you know, hey, go figure.
Well, and you've got that whole Raven going back to, I'm trying to figure out how to describe this world.
Azeroth, I think it is.
Yeah, is the name of it. But it's weird how much it almost mimics Wonder Woman.
And Paradise Island and stuff.
Paradise Island, exactly. Even some of the aesthetics.
If you took Paradise Island, took out the Greco-Roman theming, and themed it very heavily with ravens.
Yeah.
What I hadn't really appreciated before is how everybody in there has one of those Raven cloaks.
Yes.
Because that isn't something I really recall about that place. So we get some interesting stuff there, and this is something that over the years will come back a few times, because Trigon, like any really good cosmic big bad, you're not going to get rid of him just the once.
No.
He's going to come back. But definitely the aesthetic there is ornate.
Yeah.
And it's no better artist to have that with than Perez.
Yeah, and then you get the setup of, you know, who Trigon was and how he came to be and how Raven came to be and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, somehow done masterfully in two or three pages, basically.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit of an exposition dump, but to cover, you know, Trigon's whole origin and all of that in a concise time and space frame, yeah, it's going to be an info dump.
Yeah, but again, it's fascinating because you're wondering what is going on.
Yeah. Well, and you get a sense of his backstory, and you know he's a threat, but at this point, it's still not clear quite how big of a threat.
Yeah. And then you get the obligatory Justice League Titans fight.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was a ton of fun. I particularly liked how Robin was able to handle Green Lantern in fairly short order.
Yes.
And then Batman's like, all right, Robin, that's quite enough. It's so the epitome of their relationship at that point.
Yeah.
You know, go behave, young man, or whatnot. And it's funny because that's almost a reversal from how the previous Titan series was, where the adults were taken, you know, seriously, and the kids were, I don't say ridiculed, but almost cliche. Here, Batman's almost kind of the cliche father.
Yeah, and then you get, well, you get the summoning and the disappearance, apparent decay, whatever you want to say, of the Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, is such, yeah.
Well, it's basically a callback to the second issue where Raven gave Grant an illusion to kind of get him past something, and this was how she was able to kind of snap the Titans out of where they were in.
Yep.
But then they've actually got to go deal with what's going on with the wizards and stuff. But the Justice League's there. They'll handle it. So they basically, you know, kick the kids off to the side, which doesn't last for too long. And just the standoff at the end after the battle is done between the two teams, it was really kind of a, I don't say coming-of-age moment for Robin, but this is one of the pivotal eras of his history where he stops being the later part of Batman and is becoming kind of one of the premier leaders of super teams in the DC Universe.
Well, and particularly that kind of moment where, it's him and Batman standing toe-to-toe and, you know, Robin going, you're wrong, you made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And that the Titans are not a junior version of the Justice League. They're heroes in their own right. That was one of the things with Dick Grayson that some of the writers actually played with and appreciated over the years, is while Batman may be the better fighter, may be the better tactician, the better detective, whatever, Dick Grayson, Nightwing, Robin is not that far behind. And he's got the interpersonal skills and friendships with so many heroes that he's actually better at assembling a team and leading it than Batman usually is.
Yes. Dick Grayson is clearly more empathetic than Bruce, no doubt about it,
mm-hmm.
and builds better relationships than Bruce. It's hard, and maybe it's just me as the huge bat. It's hard to even think Dick is close to Bruce as a tactician, detective, any of those things. But clearly more human, I guess is the best way to put it.
I think the difference is that Nightwing is a better field leader for the Titans and most other teams he's dealt with.
Absolutely.
As much because the people will listen to him as anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that I agree with 100%.
I think that Batman is pretty much the better in all areas except acrobatics than Nightwing.
Sure.
But I don't think Nightwing is that far behind, and I think his personality type and attitude gets him a lot further at times.
Oh, absolutely.
Than Batman.
No, absolutely. I agree with all that. Yeah, no. Dick is much more the people person.
The other thing I find interesting about the team dynamics at this point is there's still some dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
Can they trust Raven? Starfire, Cyborg, and Raven are new to the team. They haven't really worked with Garfield that much. And really, Robin, Kid Flash, and Wonder Girl, for all intents and purposes, kind of sort of retired. Yet they come together as a cohesive fighting unit almost instinctively and immediately.
In some ways, yes. There's still some dysfunction there. You know, at one point you get Wally questioning. Raven throws a lot of complexity at them that sometimes strains their relationships too, even if they have known each other longer.
Absolutely, but there are a couple of times, and it's like Robin's thought balloons and stuff like that, where he's impressed that while the team's not perfect, it's gelling surprisingly well for people who've kind of just met.
Yeah.
And that was something I hadn't really recalled about these initial few issues, because I have more memories of ones that are not too much further down the line, where, of course, Robin being Robin is having the team train.
Yeah.
You know? Let's go play capture the flag. You've got to go tag me before this, or, you know, you two are going to go spar or something like that. So it's a cohesive-ish team, certainly not perfect. There's definitely issues with why is Wally there, you know, what's going on with Raven and some stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it's a well-balanced team personality-wise.
And yeah, we're left with the Titans and the Justice League walking away from each other. And
well, and most importantly, from Raven.
Yeah, both of them walking away from Raven.
Yeah, her credibility and loyalty is completely called into question. Her manipulation of Wally is revealed. And neither the Justice League or the Titans really kind of believe her claims that Trigon is coming, or if they do, they don't really care.
Yeah.
So that's one of those things where, you know, we're teased at the end that we're going to get the origin of Raven and surprises galore next issue and stuff like that. But this issue, the basic story of the Titans versus the Justice League, beginning, middle, and end, it had stuff set up from the previous issue, stuff that's going to play out in the next issue, but it was a very satisfying story chunk in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's great.
And that's really what I love about this era of comics. You get a full story every issue. Yeah, there are plot threads and character moments and stuff like that to connect them from issue to issue, and it feels like you're watching a day in the life of the characters, and it's sequential days, not just some disconnected story.
Yeah. I have discovered this is, and even though this is slightly before I was reading regularly, this is my favorite era too.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just, the storytelling is so well done, and it's true serialized storytelling as opposed to just a collection of chapters, which is a very different thing.
Yeah. I mean, these individual stories build into a larger narrative.
Yes.
But a lot of today's stories have that larger narrative split into chunks.
Yes.
And that, again, may seem like semantics, but to me, it's a very different sort of storytelling style.
No, it is. It's amazingly different.
And I think Marv Wolfman does a terrific job on the writing here, and around this time, Paul Levitz was doing some brilliant stuff over on Legion of Superheroes, which was another popular team at DC at the time. Claremont, I think, was doing stuff on X-Men at the time. So there was some definite competition in terms of writing and whatnot. And then, man, George Perez is just an amazing artist. And I really think he gets into kind of one of the peaks of his talent and career and stuff during his crazy long run on this series. You know, he had some times he went off to do other things and whatnot. And I would say that these couple of issues are not his best work, but
there's certainly nothing wrong with them.
Oh, absolutely nothing wrong with it. I think it's still brilliant. I'd be happy if I could draw a quarter as good as that. But then after a couple of years of working with these characters and you know, continuing to refine his craft, by the time we get to the Baxter series, which is just about 4 years down the line from this, and it's called the Baxter series because it was the Baxter Press. It was a new printing methodology and process that was just crisper, higher resolution. It was more modern technology, if you will, than the old newsprint type stuff. Because if you look at these pages, it's pretty flat colors. Not pretty flat. It's entirely flat colors.
They're flat colors. Absolutely. That said, I actually think Adrian Roy deserves a lot of credit because these colors are stunning. Mm-hmm. And they pop. And they're the color combinations. And I mean, these are vibrant, vibrant pages. Yes, they're flat. But man, are they vibrant, bright comic book colors.
I mean, there are a couple of places. Like, if you look at the last page of issue 4, when they're walking off and we've got, like, Robin's boots and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
there's a little edge highlight or whatever, but it's nothing compared to what we get today. But there's also a vibrance of, like you said, the colors. When you've got a blue boot in front of Raven and a blue costume and stuff, yet there's a clear distinction between the two because they're a little bit different blues and stuff like
yeah.
that. And just the characters pop off the page.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And like I said, a lot of that's the artwork, but you know, some of it's the coloring too.
Well, and I think the colorists for this era really, they had their work cut out for them because of the technology constraints they were doing this with. They were literally marking, okay, this color is going to go here, this color is going to go here, and then somebody else did the physical aspect of putting the right color in the right places and such.
Did they have to, was this back when they still had to physically cut the film?
I think so.
Wow.
If I recall correctly, and I have never been a colorist, much less in that era of comics, but they would have the black and white page, and they would basically be saying, color 12 goes here, color 15 goes there, you know, color 14 or 38 yep. or whatever goes there.
And then they had to cut out the film and lay it over the page for the photography, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
It was like acetate or something like that. It was a totally different era.
That being said, if it is as good as the coloring is, I've got to imagine at least the collection I'm reading has been recolored because there's no way they were that firm. You know, in when you see those occasionally, you see the slight slip in the photography mm-hmm. and I didn't notice any of that in this book. So it might have been touched up in the modern collection.
I'm certain for the trade it was redone, but the colors still popped on the original stuff too.
Oh, absolutely.
And then when they got to where they could do, you know, full bleed pages, they had the higher resolution kind of images and stuff. That's when George Perez's pencils just become insane. And again, he doesn't skimp on the detail, but there's only so much at this point in time that would come out on the printed page.
Yeah.
So I think this is some great stuff. 4 25-page stories plus a 14-page preview and stuff. So, you know, 114 pages, and we're, you know, only halfway through this trade.
And while I notice they go through quite a few of them in these issues, I will say this too. For fans of old-fashioned great inking, the inking work done in this series is really good too.
Mm-hmm. They had one primary inker.
Well, here's the thing. Now, almost all these issues, it lists Wolfman and Perez, writer, creators, layouts, and it lists a finisher, and it's a different person. There's several different ones just in these first four issues.
Okay.
Romeo Tangahill seems to be the first couple.
Yeah, Romeo Tangahill, I think, was the main one who did some of the inks, but around this time, Dick Giordano was doing some inks.
And you get a Frank Tremonti on issue 3.
Yeah. And part of it may have just been who was available at the time,
yeah.
Given, you know, everything they were doing.
Yeah. But again, they are all well done.
Mm-hmm.
And in a preview of when we move on to issue 5, another issue that, again, just art that I love, you get guesting penciler Kurt Swan. So it's different, but it's hard to go wrong with a Kurt Swan pencil book, too.
It's different, but it's the same school of art style.
Absolutely. And again, I think the colors and the inks, you do have Tannehill inking, it looks like, and you've still got the colorist. It all bleeds. It's not remarkably noticeable as a different artist.
Yeah. Well, and again, Kurt Swan, at this era in time, was like one of the Superman artists.
Well, he was the, I mean, this is 80?
Yeah, 80, 81.
So this is 4 or 5 years before he hands the pencil over to John Byrne and retired.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he was known. So he was the Superman man at the time.
And at this point, they had a couple of just iconic artists over at DC. And again, George Perez was doing Justice League and stuff like that, but basically handed that off eventually to where he could stay on this title.
Yeah.
Because it was doing gangbusters for DC. It took a little bit to kind of, you know, ramp up or whatnot, but it was definitely one of the high-profile books of the era for DC.
Yeah, and I think another thing, as long as we're talking about the creative team, one that people don't always think of, but man, Len Wein is the editor, probably had a lot to do with this book's success as well.
I think so. I think one of the other things, though, that really worked in their favor was the fact that I think both Wolfman and Perez lived in the same basic neck of the woods.
Yep.
So they would get together, you know, in person on a regular basis.
Yep.
Hammer out the plot. How do you want to do this? And it really got to where it wasn't, okay, here's Wolfman's script and, you know, Perez is going to draw it. They were really co-creators when this thing really got, you know, chugging along.
Well, yeah, and there are, and to be fair, they are listed as such.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all the way through. But, you know, again, I'm trying to remember, this is that. Carmine Infantino is probably still the main editor at the time. And I do think if he had, maybe Len just had the common sense to step away and let these guys do what they were going to do. But I do think if Infantino was the editor of this book, it probably would have been very different.
Yeah, probably. I think having somebody like Infantino that...
Is he still... It's right towards the end, but...
Well, I'm trying to think if he'd worked on the previous Titans series.
That was Bob Haney, wasn't it, mainly?
On the writing, I'm just trying to think if Infantino was involved either at editorial or some other position.
Yeah.
I think having the freedom to do the style of story they did here, that was almost a high-action soap opera.
Let's see, my Bronze Age omnibus lists on the cover Bob Haney and Robert Kaniger. So there's the era for that one.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think who was the editors and stuff that were kind of shaping the vision in some way.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is just some great stuff. I think New Teen Titans is a must read for anyone who likes DC of this era. It's just some terrific stuff.
Yeah. No, absolutely. These are amazing.
But they are not short reads.
No, but they're fun. They're enjoyable. You want to keep reading them.
Oh, absolutely. They're easy reads.
Yes.
But between 25 pages, a full kind of a plot, so many characters, and a lot happening on each page, it's a much more rewarding, I think, reading experience than most of today's comics.
Yeah, that may be true. But like I said, these are so good. And I think the full creative team deserves a lot of credit for all of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anything else?
I think I'm good.
Cool.
The September previews comes out on August 26th, so the preview spotlight deadline for September is going to be Saturday morning, September 5th, bright and early that morning. Please send in clips. These episodes live or die based on your input. It's a great way to share your love of comics and to highlight the stuff you enjoy so other people pick it up, and it sells better, and it sticks around. And right now, the creators could use your help, the titles could use your help, the stores could use your help. So let's get some people excited about some comics. So once again, the preview spotlight deadline for September 2020 is Saturday morning, September 5th. And a quick reminder that we've also got the recommendation roundtable episodes going. The point of those episodes is to help people find other ways to spend their time. So send in pics of comic books, either older ones, back issues, trades, whatever, novels, television shows, movies, video games, if there's a board game you think people might really enjoy or something. Let's get that out there. We've got a lot of ways we can spend our time in helping people find things that they might be interested in. It's just a great thing to do. I've gotten a lot of clips from Billy Hogan. I want to thank him for that. It reminded me that I should really go reread Astro City and put a few other things kind of back on my radar, including a couple of novels he recommended. I've added those to my reading list. We'll see when I get to them. But we've got
got no deadline for these episodes. The way these episodes work is you send in one clip per pick, and that could be a particular book or video game or TV show, or it could be a series of books, anything that's kind of a unified thing. And when I get enough of those clips, I'll string them together, I'll kick out an episode. So that means if I get tons of clips, like when Billy sent me about, I don't know, an hour and 45 minutes of some great clips, that was enough for me to get two episodes put together, about an hour for one and about 45 minutes or so for the other. So that's what episodes 2 and 3 are. But if I don't get clips, it may be a while before that next episode comes out. And the reason I'm doing this is there are a lot of things hitting, like, the streaming services and stuff like that on not really a set cadence like we've got for the preview spotlight. So if you wake up one morning and say, you know what, there's a bunch of stuff I think people might enjoy, spend a few minutes, send in the clips, they get in the queue. And if it's another few months before you do the next one, that's great. But hopefully we have enough people sending in clips on a regular enough basis that we can be putting one of these episodes out every month, every other month, or something like that. So, once again, the point here is just to recommend older comic books, novels, television shows, movies, video games, or anything else that doesn't really fit the format of the preview spotlight, but that you really want to kind of share your love of and encourage other people to check out. So, once again, there's no deadline on those recommendation roundtable clips. It's an open invitation for everybody at all times. So please send in clips when you've got something you're thinking about and share the love. Join us next week as James and I take a look at the comics we got in August 2020. And then in 2 weeks as James and I look at Why the Last Man, issues 1 through 5. And then in 3 weeks when Sam and I come back and finish off the New Teen Titans Volume 1 trade paperback covering issues 5 through 8 of the original New Teen Titans series. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.